This lecture, entitled From Slave to Viceroy, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Shulman family. As we've previously pointed out, besides the deep insights into the spirit and letter of the law, the Torah, which Sefer Bereishis, the book of Genesis, gives us, it also provides us with a framework with which to understand the shape and form that future Jewish history would eventually take. In the previous lectures, we touched upon the relations between the Arabs and the Jews, between the church, the era of Rome, and Jewry, and between the kingdom of Edom, or Edomia, and Yehuda, or Judea, which were shaped by the events recorded in Sefer Bereishis, Genesis. We also spoke about the rivalry between brothers, Yaakov and Esav, Yosef and his brothers, and the root causes of their conflicts. We'd like to begin this lecture with a topic that seems, at least on the surface, to be unrelated to the rest of the story which we have been following. The following narrative, recorded in chapter 38 of Genesis, in Parshas Vayeshev, relates solely to Yehuda, the son of Yaakov, the brother of Yosef, to his family, and not to the rest of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, or to their eventual enslavement in Egypt, the subject of the previous and subsequent narratives. Nevertheless, it is the story with enormous significance as it shaped the future of Yehuda, the leader of his brethren, and Yehuda's progeny, the leaders of the entire Jewish people, including Beis Dovid, the house of David, and Melech HaMashiach, the Messiah. The story begins after Yosef is sold into slavery. And it's on the first page, paragraph A. And it came to pass at that time that Yehuda went down from his brothers and turned to a certain Adullamite, whose name was Chira. And Yehuda saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. And we're going to touch upon the fact that these names specifically are mentioned, Chira, Shua, but the daughter of Shua is not mentioned by name. And she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. And she conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again conceived and bore a son, and called his name Shelah. And he was in Kaziv when she bore him. Alternately, it's understood that Kaziv is not just a name place, but rather Kaziv has a connotation of disappointment, or she stopped having children after she bore Shelah. And Yehuda took a wife for Er, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And Er, Yehuda's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. And Yehuda said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and marry her, and raise up seed to your brother." And this is really an allusion to the idea of Yibum, of the levirate marriage. And Onan knew that the seed would not be his. And it came to pass, when he went into his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest that he should give seed to his brother. And again, this is an allusion to the, as we're going to touch upon, the whole idea of Yibum, that what happens with the seed, what happens with the child. Evidently, it seems from this that that seed is really connected to the deceased brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he slew him also. Then said Yehuda to Tamar's daughter-in-law, and it would seem to be Yehuda was not aware of what had happened here. He just saw that this woman had married and both sons had died. "Remain a widow at your father's house until Shelah, my son, be grown." For he said, like he said to himself, "Lest perhaps he die also as his brothers did." And Tamar went and lived in her father's house. And there's a question, was Yehuda's intention just to push her off, but she would never marry Shelah? Or he wanted to wait until Shelah would be an adult, that perhaps would he would fulfill the mitzvah of Yibum himself, of the levirate marriage, that would perhaps be a protection for him. The Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the famed Rosh Yeshiva of the Voloshiner Yeshiva, explains in his commentary, Hamik Dover, the following. This is the bottom of the first page. And he comments on it, it came to pass at that time. It is clear from the text that, quote-unquote, that time was the cause of the events that followed. Now, Rashi explained that at that time, they reduced Yehuda from his position of leadership amongst the brothers, for he should have been more responsible and stopped the sale of Yosef. After they saw the reaction of the father, their father Yaakov, they blamed Yehuda that he should have been more assertive in his leadership, and perhaps just avoided the whole notion, just scared Yosef, and then just brought him back to the father. But according to that explanation, only the beginning of the narrative, Yehuda went down from his brothers, has any connection with the above, and not the whole narrative. In the Medrash Rabbah, however, it says, quoting the following verse in Isaiah, before she labored, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a son, which is, to be understood, is a metaphor, that before the birth of the first enslavement was born the final Redeemer. In other words, what this whole story is doing is this is really this is laying the seed for Melech HaMashiach, for the Messiah, which is really a descendant of Yehuda through Tamar, and through Peretz, the child that was born of this union. And therefore, this is really the beginning of the enslavement of Jewry was about to begin. But before it was about to begin, and that enslavement was the beginning of a process of enslavement that would last for thousands of years. And before that was about to begin, in earnest, the seeds of redemption were planted. The Netziv also deals with a different problem with the text. As we touched upon, the special details of the story, for instance, the name of Yehuda's close friend Chira, the name of his father-in-law Shua, and also we're going to see the name of his daughter-in-law Tamar, they're all named. And he says on page 2, referring to the text, and turned to a certain Adulamite from Adulam, whose name was Chira. And he says, it is not clear why the whole subject of Chira is mentioned in this narrative. There was no reason to mention his name, even in conjunction with his role as Yehuda's messenger in delivering the kid to Tamar. It's only mentioned here. Rather, it came to teach us that just as the birth of Mashiach, because it's viewed, as he explained, this whole narrative is really to explain the birth of Mashiach. This began its emergence through the involvement of a great and respected man of such stature that Yehuda became his fast friend. So too will it be in the future. For the building of the temple of the house of King David was through the involvement of Hiram, the king of Tsur. And notice the resemblance between Chira and Hiram. Regarding the days of Mashiach, it is written, quoting from a verse in Isaiah, and kings shall be your foster fathers. In other words, people of prestige will also help Mashiach in the end of days. And the Tziv continues to explain some further details, and he says, Yudah took a wife for Er's firstborn, whose name was Tamar. So he says, Er at that time was only 8 years old, as it's stated in Sanhedrin, chapter Ben Sora, 69b. It was only because Yehuda desired to increase his seed, and he wasn't able himself to be able to take another wife, as his wife was the daughter of Shuam. As we explained, the word Kaziv means not only there was a name, the place of a city, but really it meant she stopped having children. And he wanted to have more children. But he had a father-in-law, Shua was a man of prestige, he could not take another wife for himself. There would have been too much tension. And it would be dishonor for him to take another wife in addition to Shua's daughter. And now that he saw that he couldn't have any more children with her, he made the effort to hurry and give an older woman to his son who was still young. As she was older, she was more likely to bear children from him. I'm just put in the, I put in the brackets in this earlier period of history, as it's stated in Sanhedrin 104a in the Medrash Eicheres Rabosi, says that they used to marry off a young girl to an adult and a minor to a full-grown woman. They might bear many, many children. It seems that before a certain age, they're not, the children are, even though they, it's possible, at least in that early stage in history, they could have children, but they were not that fertile. But they married them off to someone who was extremely fertile, and that way to ensure that they would have children. That's what Yehuda did, at least according to the Netziv. And he explains whose name was Tamar, and I guess the importance of naming her. She was very prestigious, and as even though we don't have the backdrop of where she came from, but evidently just by naming her, it's indicative that she was a person of prestige, as she was worthy of being mentioned by name. For that reason, she merited the seed of the kingdom of Israel should issue forth from her. And the story continues here on page 3. In the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Yehuda's wife, died. And Yehuda was comforted, and he went up to his sheep shearers in Timnas, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnas to shear his sheep." And evidently it would seem, therefore, he stopped the mourning, he began normative life, and it really was a possibility then that he would marry another woman. I mean, it's just from the context. And she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself. And evidently no one would see that she left her home. They wouldn't identify. And sat in an open place. This is the place, Einayim. And there's a question how this is to be interpreted. Which is, by the way, to Timnas. And that's where he was, in Timnas, Yehuda. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him for his wife. When Yehuda saw her, he thought her to be a harlot. And now it's not clear when she originally came there that she wanted to speak to Yehuda, thinking that she was a harlot. But in any case, when he saw her, and because she had covered her face, he immediately thought she was a harlot. I mean, even if she had wanted to speak to him on a different level and speak about the marriage, and if it won't be Shelah, perhaps it's you, it got off to an interesting start. And he turned to her by the way and said, "Come, I beg you, let me come into you," for he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And there's a very interesting, there's a medrash that says when Yehuda originally saw her and thought her to be a harlot, he turned away. What does he have to do with harlots? And it says that there was a spiritual force, a malach, that came, that overcame him. That really he lost his free will. Like he was being pushed into this. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "I will send you a kid from the flock." She said, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your signet." I mean, these were very valuable things. "Your bracelets," or the psilim, or it's interpreted fringes, as we'll see, "and your staff that is in your hand." And he gave them to her and came into her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and went away, took off her veil, put on the garments of her widowhood. And Yehuda sent the kid by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand. He assumed that she was a harlot, and she was stationed. But he found her not. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where's the harlot who was at Einayim?" And we say it means a crossroads or a guest house by the wayside. And they said, "There was no harlot in this place." He returned to Yehuda and said, "I can't find her." And also the men of the place said, "There was no harlot in this place." And Yehuda said, let her take it to her, let her have it, lest we be shamed. Because he didn't want to continue this on. "Behold, I sent this kid, and you have not found her." What is this thing, Einayim, this open place? So the Hamikdavar explains, in those countries there were no inns by the roadside, only empty houses, which are situated at certain intervals, in which no one actually lived, like it was like a youth hostel or whatever. Anyone who needed to stay overnight came and stayed there overnight. I guess it was provided for by the community. This was called Einayim. There were empty beds that were provided there. So that's actually, it's because of that reason they had relations there. And he continues on, and he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. And he explains, if her face had been uncovered, he would have recognized her from a distance that she was Toma. But since her face was covered, he thought her to be a harlot. After he made up his mind she was a harlot, he was unable to recognize her from her voice, as it never entered his mind that Toma, his daughter-in-law, was so prestigious, would be involved in harlotry, God forbid. That's why her voice was not a clear indication of who she really was. Just in the case of Yitzchak, who didn't realize that it was Yaakov from his voice. Evidently, he's understanding that the voice, the tone of the voice of Yaakov's was different than Esau. You know, we had explained because the way of expression was different. It was much more refined. But the Hamakdover's understanding, just the tone was different. So why didn't he, since he had made up his mind based on the feel of his hands, that it was Esau? And he explains the idea of the signet ring, your fringes, bracelets, and your staff that's in your hand. And he writes, it is possible that the fringe, which was connected to his outer garment, was made of tchelis, wool that was specially dyed the color of sky blue, so that he remembers the throne of glory. This is how the Talmud explains the significance of the blue thread. You know, that which was the custom of the children of Yaakov. Now these three things which he took as a pledge signified three special qualities. The signet ring is the sign of a lawgiver. It's basically when you write a law, whatever it is, and then you seal it with a signet ring. The fringe is indicative of one who meditates, absorbed with the fear of God. This is the color blue. And the staff is the symbol of a ruler. Really, these are the three facets of Yehuda and what made him so special, and in a sense indicative of what will make his progeny, Moshiach, the house of David, so special. And the story continues on, and it came to pass about 3 months after, it was told to Yehuda, saying, Tomer, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and also behold, she's with child by harlotry. And Yehuda said, bring her out and let her be burned. And there's a question, the Talmud understands, and this is the understanding we're going to be quoting, it actually means to be killed. It's to be killed by burning. There are alternate commentaries that explain it really means to be branded. You know, it's this sign of shame of a harlot. But the translation we're going to go with is that of that it means death. When she was brought out, she sent her father-in-law saying, by the man whose these are, am I with child. But she didn't want to embarrass him. At that point, she could have said, you know, he's the father. We're going to come on this further. And she said, discern, I beg you, haker no. Discern, please, whose are these, the signet and bracelets and staff? And Yehuda acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I. Really, the Hebrew, tzotka mimeni, which could be understood alternately, tzotka, she's righteous. Mimeni, from me, in other words, she became pregnant from me. Question how to translate this. Because I did not give her to Shelah, my son. And therefore she, because of the levirate marriage, she was practicing this, in a sense, by Yehuda would be the father and continue on the seed. This is before the Torah really formalized that it was only through the brother. But before the Torah was given, it could have really been through the father as well. And he knew her again no more. And again, there's a question how to interpret this. Does it mean he stopped? Or he didn't stop, as we're going to say. And it came to pass in the time of her labor that behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she labored that one put out his hand and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this came out first, as you want to know who the firstborn is. And it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out, and she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself," and as you've really pushed yourself out. Therefore, his name was called Peretz. Peretz, which means the Peretz, like Peretz together, means to make a breach. And afterwards came out his brother, who had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerach. 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 About the nature, we said about what this burning is, and why was she punished in such a manner, the following is the approach taken by the great Talmudist and biblical commentator, Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman. This is the bottom of page 4. And Yehuda said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." And now he quotes from the Medrash, Ephraim Makshah, disciple of Rabbi Meir, said on the authority of Rabbi Meir, quote, "Tamar was the daughter, or perhaps granddaughter, of Shem, who was a Kohen." According to the sages of the Talmud, identify Malkitzedek, the king of Sholem, who is the priest of the Most High God, as being identified with Shem, the son of Noach. Therefore, they condemned her to burning. End quote. Now, the law is that law in the Torah itself, which is really would not apply before the Torah was given, but the law in the Torah itself is that if a daughter of a Kohen has an adulterous affair, anyone, and this adultery, the crime, the punishment of the crime of adultery, of course, as with witnesses and warning, is death. But her death, in particular, is through burning. Actually, according to Talmudic tradition, they're not burned at the stake, but rather what happens is that that molten lead is poured down the throat, which she dies instantaneously. I know it's not so geschmack. Now he continues on, the Ramban. The above is a quote from Rashi's commentary. That was real. He didn't, however, explain it. "I'm personally not aware of such a law. That which the daughter of a Kohen is condemned to death by burning is only if she is an extramarital affair after either betrothal," you know, like after the ring is given, "or marriage," they start to live together as man and wife, "as clearly stated in Sanhedrin 51b. A daughter of a Kohen who is waiting for her deceased husband's brother to perform the duty of a husband's brother, Yibum, is to take over the marriage, is not at all punished with death, whether she's the daughter of an Israelite or Kohen. She's only in violation of a negative commandment. And don't say that the laws of Yibum are in effect for B'nai Noach." That would be another possible solution here. The descendants of Noach, meaning humanity in general. "In accordance with their legal system, she is considered to be akin to a married woman. And the penalty for any violation of any law in that system is death." As the Gemara in Sanhedrin 58b, because the sages say that, this is based on Medrash Rabbah, the Yehuda was the very first to perform the mitzvah of Yibum. This was not a common thing. It wasn't that mankind as a whole maintained her to be really married to the brother of the deceased and just had to be consummated with this ritual of Yibum. She was free to go out. In their system. It was only later on the Torah system. Yehuda was really the first to practice this, and it was really based on the Torah's system, and really not the Noahide system. Similarly, the Ramban continues, "It is evident from the Gemara," and he quotes Gemara 57b in Sanhedrin, "there's no penalty at all in the system of B'nai Noach if a Yavama, a widow waiting for Yibum, has an affair." It seems that because of this, he has difficulty with that interpretation. He wants to offer Ramban a different interpretation. He says the following: "It seems to me that Yehuda was an officer, judge, and ruler in the land. In such a situation, a daughter-in-law who would act immorally would not be judged like any other individual. We would consider as if she disgraced the government." You know, this was a different time, and different kinds of government. "That is why it is written," this is in in the 38th chapter in Genesis. And Yehuda said, bring her out and let her be burned. As they came before him with the intention of carrying out anything he would command them. This is the that he had the power, basically, of a king. And the king has the latitude to, under certain critical situations, to give a much more severe punishment than normally would be allowed. A parallel would be declaration of martial law in times of rioting. Looters will be shot. Looting does not come normally, it does not carry with it a death penalty. But it's because of the whole system, the whole society is really falling apart, that such a severe punishments are meted out. It's based on a similar type, in times of extreme of emergency. And it continues on, he condemned her to death for the sake of the honor of the government, and specifically condemned her to die by burning, akin to someone to dishonor their father and honor the office of his priesthood. In other words, if the daughter of a Kohen, so we have the idea of a more severe punishment because of the disgrace to the father. So basically what he was doing is he was going to condemn her to death. Why he chose this particular mode of death was because it was akin to the idea of disgrace. But this judgment would not have applied to an ordinary person. This is the Ramban's approach to this. We discussed in the previous lecture the notion of trickery, how Yaakov tricked his father and was ultimately tricked by Yehuda in the incident of the goat's blood drenched coat of Yosef. Then again, Yosef was sold, but they slaughtered a goat. They took the blood and took the coat. This is the Sonus Possum. They took the special coat of Yosef, dipped it into the blood, and it looked like he had been wounded, at least, if not murdered. Here again, we see the principle: says what goes around comes around. Now, in this story, Yehuda himself is tricked by Tamar. Granted, it was for a just cause, but still in all, it came through trickery. And the same expression that Yehuda used, haker no, that he used to his father Yaakov, please recognize this, was used on Yehuda himself, this time to his great embarrassment. As we quoted from the Medrash in Zohar, Hashem judges tzaddikim, righteous ones, very precisely, expects from them a very high standard of behavior. This is how the Medrash expresses this idea, is number 3 on page 5. Rabbi Yochanan said, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Yehuda, you said, haker no, know now, please recognize. End quote. By your life, I swear that Tamar will tell you, please recognize. This is mida keneged mida. This is the person's punishment is meted out, measure for measure. There are yet other lessons to be learned from this story. First of all, from the dignity and saintliness of Tamar, not to embarrass Yehuda. The Gemara in Brachos and Mem Gimel and Beis in 43b and the Sota 10b derives the principle that it is better to be thrown into a fiery furnace, as in the case of Tamar, rather than embarrass someone in public. In addition, we see from Yehuda's behavior a form of courage, that he endured the terrible embarrassment of the public disclosure that he, a person of tremendous stature, had visited what he thought to be a harlot in order to save Tamar. Especially in the light of what Ramban said, that he was about to kill her because of the disgrace, and yet it's he was the one who was really guilty of this. So really, too, it was a tremendous sign of courage. In the words of the Gemara in Sota in 10b, and Yehuda acknowledged them and said, either she's more righteous than I, as we explained, as she is righteous, it is from me. Sotka, mimeni. That is what Rav Chanan bar Bizna said in the name of Shimon, Chassidah the pious. Yehuda, sanctified the heavenly name in public, merited the whole of his name should be called after the name of the Holy One, blessed be He. As Yehuda has 5 letters, 4 of those letters are the same letters as God's name, the Tetragrammaton, the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey. When he confessed and said, she is more righteous than I, or she is righteous, is for me, a bas kol issued forth and proclaimed, thou didst rescue, you rescued Tomer and her two sons from the fire. By your life, I will rescue through your merit three of your descendants from the fire. And these words recorded in the book of Daniel, Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. You can look at the rest here. Now, as we quote in the beginning of this lecture, this incident, which happened prior to their being exiled into Egypt, is the story of the creation of Mashiach, the ultimate redeemer from exile. The Netziv gives us a special insight into this. And he says, it is not clear how the birth of Peretz is more indicative of the blossoming of Mashiach than the birth of Yehuda himself, who was the progenitor of the line that would produce the anointed king. This is in the final generation of mankind. Where do we see from Peretz's birth something special about Mashiach? So he says the following. The first answer is that Peretz's birth, one which breached through the normative natural way of childbirth, is a clear indication that his progeny will be royalty, possess the power to break through barriers in order to create a new path for themselves. But the ultimate answer is that when people, that's one, but he said the ultimate answer is when people of Israel saw that the beloved twins Peretz and Zerach were people of the highest spiritual level, they understood that from them would be produced the anointed king who would break through barriers in order to create a new path of spirituality. And this is one thing that a king, any king, has the power of breaking through limitations. He can build a road where he feels it's important to build a road, even though he has the, you know, the power of eminent domain. He'll force the people or whatever it is, the landowners, to give over the land, and he'll break through, so to speak. But there's something special about these people because of their spiritual heights. And they said the breaking through is not just through physical barriers, but spiritual barriers, as it's written, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. Or he will, there's a different way to explain, but he will have a unique sense. The Yorach is explaining also that he has a smell. He is sensitive. He could look at a person and sense what their spirit, this is about the Mashiach, what the person's spiritual level is. His power will be such that Balaam said of him, and he will destroy the falsehoods of all of the sons of mankind. We explain this verse in our commentary there to mean that Mashiach will destroy the beliefs of the sons of Seth, so that the idols and idolatry will be utterly destroyed. So this is how he views it. It was a sign that these were people who will really break through. The Malbim, basing himself on Kabbalistic sources, explains the story on a whole different level. And he says, and it came to pass when she labored. He says, the Kabbalists have already explained that Aaron and Onan came back to this world through the mystery of Yibum, levirate marriage, as Peretz and Zerach. In other words, the first two sons of Yehuda had died. They were really reborn into the new children here of this new union. That is why they're always enumerated amongst the sons of Yehuda, as I explained in my commentary to Chronicles. You know, in explaining, you know, in detailing the progeny and the relations between the founders of the people and their progeny, it's funny that Aaron and Onan are always mentioned, even though they died and didn't leave over any children. So he explained the reason they're mentioned, because actually that the subsequent children are the reincarnation of those people. So they are actually also progenitors of children. Er reincarnated into Peretz and Onan into Zerach. Now Zerach wanted to go out first, as Onan wasn't as bad as Er. The Zerach evidently he's first called, he's simply called bad, in other words, heir. According to Chazal, he explained that he really didn't want his wife to become pregnant at all. That's why he spilled the seed, wanted to keep her beauty. Evidently, Onan knew that he was bad and didn't want to continue that person on. And that's why he spilled the seed. But it seems that from him, the ma, that Er was the worst. So that's why he felt he should come out. So one put out his hand. It was, for from Zerach there descended prophets. What's the symbolism sticking out the hand? And also Zerach is, the word Zorach means is to shine, because it was a bright crimson thread. So he says, from Zerach really was the progenitor of prophets and men of the Holy Spirit. Asen Ezrachi, Haman, Kalkol, Sazandarda, men of whom the hand of God, the Holy Spirit, was felt. That's the idea of the hand also, which is symbolized, is described as the hand of God. And in commenting, when Yehuda said, what a breach you have made for yourself, for Er was the firstborn, and from him issued forth the dynasty of the kings of the house of David, as it is stated also, says, I will make him my firstborn higher than the kings of the earth. And the king takes precedence over a prophet, therefore he went out first. I heard a beautiful vort. I don't remember who it was, perhaps it was from Rav Isaac Osband, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Telz Yeshiva, who had studied when he was young, before he went to Telz, in the Ponovish Yeshiva in Lithuania. And the Ponovish Rav, Yosef Kahaneman's father-in-law, this is Arius, like Reuben, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Vilkomir. And his father-in-law, the Ponovish Rav's father-in-law, said the following insight. There's a special relationship between prophets and kings. And we find, at least in the kings of Yehuda, they had their own prophets. And the prophet really was there to inspire the king, to guide the king. So really it was symbolic. Here there's two brothers and they're supposed to go out of the womb. The first one, Zerah, sticks out his hand. He tells him, that way. Sticks back his hand, okay. Then Peretz just goes right through. So really it was following the role, so to speak, of this prophet to give the direction, and then the king pushes through. So that's a very cute thing. Another idea, which I don't, because I thought I'd want to dwell upon, but topic of discussion is the idea that, as we understood this, this is the formation of Melech HaMashiach. The creation and the formation of the Messiah came through actions which were not, which would seem to be on the highest moral level. Here, comes through the joining of Tamar and Yehuda. Yehuda thinks her to be a harlot, even though, according to the Medrash, in a sense, he was forced into this, it came over him. But still in all, it came through such an action. Ultimately, this is from the side of Yehuda. From the other side, it came through Ruth. Ruth came through the union of Avram's nephew Lot with his daughters. Yeah. It's also, it comes through such a really a murky beginning. Even later on in David, we have that his son Shlomo, who eventually was the progenitor of the line of kings, mother was Bathsheba, and also they originally, their marriage also came about through something much less than the highest moral standard. And they struggle with this. I'd like to offer the following insight, and then we'll go on. A king is different than a prophet. He's different than a teacher, a Rosh Yeshiva. A king has to deal with an entire nation. Especially the Melech HaMashiach, the time of Messiah, this is the era when the Jewish people will do tshuva. The Jewish people will return. And he has to deal with a whole nation. He has to deal with Jews who are drug dealers. He has to deal with bartenders. He has to deal with some of our best who are in the federal penitentiaries throughout the country, and he has to deal with the most spiritual and the highest people. He has to have a personality that will span the entirety of the Jewish people from their heights to their depths, and to be that person that will inspire all of them. Well, it's very hard to inspire someone, to deal with someone, if you have no understanding of them. A person who is brought up in a very spiritual home has a tremendous difficulty understanding the struggles of a person who doesn't. There's a Gemara in Kedushin and Pei Aleph that describes both on different occasions Rabbi Meir and his mentors, his Rabbi Akiva, were mislotzets, made fun, were belittling Bali Avera, those who compromised their moral integrity. He says, what do you see? How could you do such a thing? So at least how the Gemara explains, and also these Gemara have to understand to what extent it's to understand, literally or figuratively, but Hashem wanted to teach them a lesson. And the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, came in the form of a woman that they couldn't resist. On one occasion, this is on Rabbi Meir, the woman was on the other side of the river. There was a very rickety bridge that he had to pass, and he went fully halfway across the river until the Yetzer Hara left him, the evil inclination left him, and he felt like a fool. And he said, I just wanted you to understand, says, what these people are going through. And the same, it's a similar thing happened to Rabbi Akiva climbing up a tree, because they couldn't understand them. And it doesn't make them any better. They're doing the wrong thing. But at least you have sympathy, says, to understand that they're struggling. You have different struggles. Everybody has struggles. But just to understand, says, so a person who's misloitzes boivri avera, who just laughs at them, again, you can't deal with them. How could you be the king of a person of that? How could you be the one who's going to inspire them? But Melech HaMashiach uniquely will have the power not only to inspire those on the highest level, but on the lowest level. And the reason he was granted that power is because he was created both on the side of Rus and the side of Yehuda, Peretz, through actions that are not of the highest moral level. And therefore it became ingrained in him, chas v'shalom, he would never experience it himself, but he could understand it. You know, there are things we don't do, we can understand. So normally, a Baal Tshuva, someone who has himself experienced it, left it, regrets it, has made a commitment to live a different life, it doesn't have any attraction to him, that life. But he could understand very well a person who is in the midst of such a thing. So Mashiach is granted that power without having sinned himself, without being a Baal Tshuva himself, just to fully understand what they're going through. And the reason is that he was given this is because his creation came through this. At least that's my theory. And why it was important that it come through this. Because ultimately he has to deal with all of Jewry. I'd just like to finish this, speaking, and finally, this incident, the founding of the house of Peretz and the eventual creation of the house of David, is linked together with the following blessings that were given at the wedding of Boaz and Ruth, which really created the Davidic line. And it says, and all the people that were in the gate, and the elders said, we are witnesses, the Lord make the woman that has come into your house like Rachel and like Leah, who both built the house of Israel. May you prosper in Ephros, and be famous in Beis Lechem, and may your home be like the house of Peretz, whom Tomer bore to Yehuda, of that seed which the Lord shall give you of this young woman. So it really puts everything together. I think on a different occasion we had shown really the relationship of the of what's embedded in the Torah, that if you in this story, I didn't tell this really not germane, just to share it with you here. In this story here, chapter 38, there are embedded in it's really, it's in reverse order, but embedded in intervals of of I believe it's 49 letters. Intervals of 49 letters. It spells backwards Rus, as you could find it in the thing. Is it Rus Boaz? Says, you know, it spells back Rus Boaz. Says Ovad Yishai David. They're all of these places are embedded in this story, which is really indicative that really this is we're speaking about the creation of the Davidic line. That ends the first part of this lecture. Now is the second part. Now the story of Yosef continues on with Yosef enjoying tremendous success and blessing in his new environment as a slave to Potiphar, the Sarat HaBochim, which alternately means, according to Rashi, the chamberlain of the butchers, referring to butchering animals, or according to Uncalus and the other commentators, the captain of the guard or executioners. Tabochim says butchers or killers in this context refers then to the enemies of the state. Before we continue on with the story, I'd like to clarify what seems to be a difficulty in the text regarding Yosef's original sale, the involvement of his brothers, and the involvement of the Midianite merchants who took him out of the pit. As if you read this, and it says, and they sat down, this is the brothers, after they put him into the pit. They sat down to eat bread, and he lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Yehuda said to his brothers, what profit is it that we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Because originally they just wanted to put him into the pit, and he should die of starvation in the pit. Says, come, says, but rather than killing him, we'll sell him as a slave. The reason they had wanted to kill him, they looked at him as the brothers looked at Yosef as a danger to them. They viewed him as another Esav, who had come to ingratiate himself to his father, and eventually the other brothers would be pushed aside, and the only heir would become Yosef. That's what they were afraid of. He says, we could accomplish that without killing him. We'll sell him into slavery as long as he's just not part of the house. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, Ishmaelim, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers were content. Then there passed by Midianite merchants, and they drew and lifted up Yosef out from the pit. And they sold Yosef to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Yosef to Egypt. Like, where do these Midianites come in here? Like, how do you read this? And again, later on, it says, at the end of this chapter, this chapter 37, you know, he was brought down to Egypt. So it would seem to be that they were sold to the Ishmaelites. So now it belongs to the Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites should be the one to sell Yosef there. But it says, and the Midianites, or it says Madonim really, sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and the captain of the guard. So are they Midianites? Are they Ishmaelites? Like, what are they? And to compound matters, and it says, and Yosef was brought down to Egypt, this is in chapter 39, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, or the chamberlain of butchers, an Egyptian, bought him from the hands of the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. So it's from the Ishmaelites. And the Lord was with Yosef, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord made all that he did, this is to prosper in his hand. And Yosef found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he made him an overseer of his house, and all that he had put, this is into his hand. And it came to pass, from the time that he made him an overseer in his house, and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field, and he left all that he had in Yosef's hands. And he knew not what he had had, save for the bread which he ate, which seems to be a euphemism for his wife. And Yosef was handsome and good looking. It introduces the next part. So here it says that was Ishmaelite. So what is this? And also, just again, in number two, it's called Madonim. Now, we discussed before that after the death of Sarah and after Avram's saw to it that Yitzchak, his son, got married to Rivka, Avram himself remarried Keturah, a woman by the name of Keturah, and they had children. One of the children was Midian, another children was Madom, two separate people. So it would seem that Midianim, which are descendants of Midian, are different people than Madonim. So possibly one could say, there's a possibility that one could say really it was a group of these two, like there was Midianites and Madonim really were together. Like it was a group of them, a group of merchants made up of these cousins, you know, these relatives. Some were Midianites, some were Madonim. And perhaps it was the Midianites who took them from the pit, and perhaps it was the Madonim part of that group that did the sale to Egypt. You know, maybe that itself would not be, but it's still very difficult. How do you read all of this? So I'd like to share with you the explanation of the Hamikdavar. There are other explanations. But his is brilliant, and it's revolutionary, and I'll share it with you. And he says the following on page 8. Then there passed by Midianim merchants. And again, we ask, what's the connection here? They said they saw Ishmaelites, which are from a different group. You know, and then we speak about these Midianites. And he says the following. They were traveling with a caravan of Ishmaelites and camels, as impossible to travel through the desert without being together with a large caravan. They traveled, however, by foot. As one could travel, maybe the speed of it was very slow. And really, you could travel by foot. I mean, the camel drivers very often are by foot, walking in tandem with the camels. So they were merchants. And for safety, they traveled with these Ishmaelites. For that reason, the brothers only saw from a distance the camels, which were tall, and not them. And those, when they saw in the distance the Ishmaelites, really what they saw were camels. And they understand, says that the Ishmaelites, were the camel drivers. Those Midianites who were traveling by foot turned off the road because they heard the voice of Yosef, and his pleading was screaming, or perhaps out of curiosity to see what was in that pit. Maybe they just saw a pit and they were just wondering what was there. And they drew and lifted up Yosef out from the pit. This is referring to the Midianites. There's really a question, who is the they? There's a pronoun. It's referring to the brothers, and some explain that, and the Midrashim to that effect. But there are others that seem to indicate, as the Netziv is learning, that actually the Midianites brought him out. The brothers who saw this rejoiced from all of this, as their wishes were fulfilled without their being directly involved. Had Yehuda not spoken up, they wouldn't have let them pull him out of the pit, but they would have left him in the pit to die. Now, as they had decided he should be sold, at that point the Midianites happened to come by, and they did the dirty work for them, so to speak. But had they decided that they had wanted their brother to die, they would never have let the Midianites take him out, because he was condemned to death. But when they decided to sell him, they were satisfied that it was done through the Midianites. Now it is stated in the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah that Yosef was stolen twice. This means the brothers stole him from their father, and the Midianites stole him from the brothers. Nevertheless, Yosef said to the brothers when he revealed himself, "You sold me here," which is in the next lecture, because they caused the thing and were aware of what the Midianites were doing, and they didn't protest. Such a thing is the equivalent of having done it themselves. Rashbam also explains this in the same way. So this explanation really is echoed from previous generations this is Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, the Shmuel ben Meir. And they brought Yosef to Egypt. This refers to the Ishmaelites who bought him from the Midianites. So they were merchants. They saw something here. And then they went to the Midianites. He says, "Would you like to sell him? You can carry him with all the goods you have." So it was the Midianites who went, according to this, and sold him to the Ishmaelites, to the the Ishmaelim. Midianites were merchants. Were plain merchants. The Ishmaelites were really bearers of merchandise. They were not hustlers. But they had, you know, here I could sell you something and carry it with all the other things you're selling. They're transporters. That's basically they were teamsters. He says, you know, you can put this on your truck too. You know, they said, you know, we don't deal in slaves. Nah, it'll be good. You know, they're merchants, so they know how to speak. You know? So they convinced them. And it continues on. And the Midian, now again, this is the Midonim, right? Which were sold into Egypt to Potiphar, says, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. He explains this totally differently than you would normally assume. He says, these were brokers. And not, says Midianites, who were involved in dealing with slaves. And this, the word Modon here does not refer to the grandson of Avram, from Keturah. It says, but rather, Modon means argumentative. This was the name of these people, because there had to be tough people dealing with slaves. They were involved in dealing with slaves, a field which demanded they have a stubborn, argumentative personality. And they sold them to Egypt, or El Mitzrayim. It should have been written in Egypt. You know, to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, is referring to the country of Egypt, the government of Egypt. The explanation, this is a very unique explanation, is stated in the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah, to the official office of the country. And he explains, the following was the common custom at that time. This is his suggestion. One came to sell a slave, and it was hard for him to wait around until he would come across a customer for a particular slave. There was a governmental body that bought the slaves and would take care of him till the slave would be taken to the slave market and sold there. They would keep him there even for an extended period until a suitable customer would be found for him. Potiphar was the one appointed over this governmental body. In other words, besides being the head of the executioners, he had other responsibilities as well. Very often you find in a minister in a parliament has more than one portfolio. So he happened to be head this governmental body as well. And he continued, and Yosef was brought down to Egypt. Rashi explained that the Torah repeated it in order to return to the first subject. I mean, that's where he begins. If so, that is only redundant. In addition, it was unnecessary to write an Egyptian in describing Potiphar. I mean, what do you say? Of course he's an Egyptian. What else is he? Furthermore, there's no reason or rationale for the statement he bought him from the hands of the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there, I mean, which is also redundant. We had already explained, however, the custom was when one came to sell a slave and found it difficult to remain and feed and guard a slave until a customer would be found, they would sell it to the governmental body over which Potiphar had been appointed. The Madonim were the brokers for the sale. In other words, they really represented, they were brokers, they dealt with the government. So they were really, what they did at that point was they took him from the Ishmaelim, and then sold him to the government, as El Mitzrayim, really to the governmental body. The law was that the appointee over this governmental slave center did not have the right to purchase the slave for himself, similar to our law that a trustee, a gabbai over a charitable fund, tzedakah, is forbidden to take from the trust for himself, even for the person exchanging coins. This is the idea of the conflict of interest. Is in order for him to remain above suspicion. If, however, the seller himself would bring the slave to the market to sell, then there's nothing to do with the governmental body, then everyone has equal access, including an official. Scripture is describing the special providence which shone upon Yosef, the fact that Potiphar acquired him for himself, which had an amazing benefit. Since Potiphar was the captain of the guards, Yosef was eventually able to meet governmental officials, the chief butler and the chief baker, who were responsible for his rise to power. Scripture relates that Yosef was brought down to Egypt to the slave market in the city and not where it previously been in the governmental slave center that was in the courtyard outside the city. Rather, he was brought down into Egypt proper and was purchased by Potiphar. So he says, how did that happen? And originally he was sent through these brokers. He was You know, he was into the slave center. Then how did he get back to be sold privately, basically, by the Ishmaelites? So he explains the following. Even though it would have been easier for Potiphar to acquire Yosef after he initially been sold to the slave center, nevertheless, Potiphar arranged that the Madonim brokers of the slave center should not bring him to the slave market. These brokers actually had two functions. They brokered to buy to the governmental center from these merchants, and they also brokered that they were sold. So they're really involved in the whole process. But rather the Ishmaelites who originally sold him should take him back and go to the market without revealing the fact to anyone that he had been sold to the slave center first. In other words, Potiphar looked at Yosef in the governmental slave center, saw he wanted him. But there's no way for him to get him. So what he did was, he went back to the Ishmaelim, he said, we're reversing this sale. So he got them to reclaim Yosef, then they went down into the area where privately the slaves are sold, and then Potiphar got him from the Ishmael, which he was allowed to do it. He couldn't get them directly through the governmental center because it would be a conflict of interest, but he could, as a private citizen, he could go buy any slave in the market. And he continues on, not only did his removal from the slave center enable Potiphar to buy him, but also directly benefited Yosef, as the Midonim slave brokers were evil people, and their normal relation with slaves would be offensive for a highly spiritual person like Yosef. The Ishmaelites, however, were merchants of other goods whose only dealing with slaves was in this particular instance. Scripture tells us Potiphar was an Egyptian, so we shouldn't think that Potiphar worked so hard to purchase Yosef because he was originally from the country of Canaan, as is common that a government would employ people whose origin was from a different country. In such a case, had he found a slave from Canaan who would be familiar with the culture of Canaanites, he would prefer him, as his service would be quite pleasant. In other words, we're saying at this point, the first thing, A, was he arranged that the sale to the Ishmaelites would be reversed, and that he bought them directly now from the Ishmaelites. B, it's saying, what did Potiphar see in Yosef? So one could perhaps say, you know what he saw in Yosef? Potiphar originally perhaps was a Canaanite. You know? So he sees a landsman. You know, he sees someone from his country. So he could deal with him, he'd feel comfortable with him having him as his slave. But he says, but that wasn't the case. Scripture specifically tells us, however, that was not the case. Rather, he was an Egyptian. Nevertheless, he tried very hard to purchase him. This was a sign of special providence. The story goes on, you could read this yourself because of the time, is about the Potiphar's wife wanted to seduce him, and a situation arose that he was very close to being actually seduced, but he controlled himself, he fled, he left his garment there with the woman, who has now had evidence that here was she claimed that he tried to rape her, and she prevailed upon her husband, and her husband then put him into prison, and he controlled the prison. But of course, we're just like he had risen to a position of power within the house of Potiphar, he rose to a position of power within the prison itself, and he actually became the acting warden of the prison, and the true warden really put everything into his hands. Referring to the, and you could read another thing else on page 11 from the Gemara and Sota about the tremendous difficulty that he had originally to resist, but he finally resisted. The Chazal speak about the fact that he saw the sages speak about that he saw the image of his father. It was really gripped by his pangs of conscience. How could he do such a thing? And he resisted. Rav Yitzchak Huttner says in this Pachad Yitzchak shares with us an amazing and an important lesson. He asked the following, Rav Huttner. We find Avram had a name change. He started with Avram, then was changed to Avraham. Yaakov had a name change. He started with Yaakov and changed to Yisrael. Yitzchak did not have a name change, and he explained the following. The name change was indicative of a change in the person. Avram changed from Avram, he was a Noahide, and he became the first convert. He became Avram. And it really was indicative of a change. He's in Yiddish, he says, Erz Geven, the Erster Gevorener, and became the first Jew who became a Jew. Yitzchak was the first Jew who was born as a Jew. He never had a name change. His position was that of continuing on, which was really created by Avram. Now, even though it was promised to Avram that Yitzchak's seed would be the descendants of Avram, but there was a hint in the verse, Ki b'Yitzchak yikor l'chozer, not all of Yitzchak, some of Yitzchak, part of it would be, continue on and some would be shunted aside. What happened was Esav was shunted aside, Yaakov was the one chosen. At the point when he was chosen, his name was changed from Yaakov to Yisroel. He became the first Jew that was permanently a Jew, because you're a Jew, you can never change. Up until that, there was a fluidity. Possibly, even though he was born a Jew, but you see, Esav also was pushed aside. It's possible to opt out. Today, a person is born a Jew. He says, you can do nothing to take yourself away from being Jewish. If you convert, you become the Pope. Still a Jew. Doesn't make a difference. So, Erz Geven, the Erste Farfallener. He says, the first one who was stuck being a Jew. That was Yaakov. But he explains there's still a way. You can't opt on your own, but there's really still a way to stop the continuity. And this really is to marry a woman who's not Jewish. So again, it doesn't continue on. This is for this, unless the woman converts, of course, but if a person doesn't convert, says, again, it doesn't continue on. This is, where does one have, generally in much of our history, we were a minority in a culture which was very different than ours. Where did we get the moral fiber to resist and to continue on? That came from Yosef. This story was not Yosef's just personal story. This was a story that really created the power in the Jewish people and says that we will continue on. And that really is really very special about Yosef. Kabbalistically, he is called Yesod, the foundation, which is the idea of continuity. It's the Bris Milah, the sign of the covenant, which is also connected Kabbalistically to the idea of Yesod. The foundation means the idea of continuity. So this story is really essential, not only just to the of Yosef, but really it's something. Really that he was able to impart this to the entire Jewish people. The story continues on while he's in prison, and this is, and it came to this is in the beginning of the 40th chapter. It came to pass after these things that the butler of the king of Egypt and his baker had offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Now it seems just a plain butler and baker. These were minor employees. And Pharaoh was angry against two of his officers, the chief of the butlers and the chief of the bakers. Because even though it was the fault of someone of the lower rank, But their ultimate supervisor is the one who was held responsible, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison, the place where Yosef was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Yosef with them. He served them, and they continued a season or a year in custody. So they were together with them, and it explains here. The Sephorno explains, as we said before, that the butler of the king and the baker, these referring to the slaves of the chief of the butler and the chief of the bakers, but Pharaoh was angry against two of his officers because they were not supervised, they had not supervised their slaves, the butler and the baker. When he put them into custody, the Netziv explains, their punishment was not to sit in prison, like a common criminal, but rather to be in custody until their case will be thoroughly investigated. For that reason, they sat in the house of the captain of the guards, which was really better, you know, the situation was better, not in the pit, the dungeon, where prisoners normally sit, such as Yosef. As it says, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. Now, that's where he was, out of the pit, later on. But here he really, there were special... there's special privileges that they were given. And it goes on to explain, you can read it yourself, about the dream. This is the famous dream. And they were very, and because of the dream, the both of them were very agitated. The Sefer Ksava Kabbalah explains some of their agitation. It says the butler and the baker, and really the difficulty is the people that Yosef was ministering to were not a simple butler and baker. They were the officials. They weren't really doing any baking or serving. They were really supervisor, managers. It's quite reasonable to assume that the statement is not coming to inform the identity of the dreamers. Rather, it's telling us that they saw in their dream a lowering of their status. They were not portrayed in the dreams as being administrators, but rather as being simple servants. This one carried a basket of baked goods, and the other squeezed out grapes into the cup. These dreams didn't relate to the role of a chief baker or a chief butler, but rather the role of the servants who were below them. This is what caused them to be so distressed. Originally, they thought they would only receive a light punishment for the lack of supervision over their servants. But because of this, however, because of the dream, they now assumed that they would receive a severe punishment, because they viewed themselves in the dream as actually as being these slaves, as if they themselves had been the ones who had been negligent in the work as bakers and butlers. The interpretation that Yosef had was that the baker would be beheaded, would be killed. But the butler, in his dream, was that he saw three branches of that had clusters of grapes, and in the dream, this official had squeezed out the grapes into the cup, which was the cup of Pharaoh. Yosef interpreted to mean that the 3 days he would be released. We quote here from the Gemara in Chul on page 14 that it was understood by them there's another interpretation, deeper interpretation. This was meant for Yosef himself about the future of the Jewish people. Because he realized really this was what his enslavement was, really the beginning of his whole nation's, his whole family's enslavement. But eventually they would go out and build a glorious nation. One of the interpretations is, really, you can read it yourself on the bottom, page 14. Rav Shimon ben Lakish said, "This people Israel is like unto a vine. Its branches are the aristocracy. Its clusters, the scholars. Its leaves, the common people. Its twigs, and these are the knots on those in Israel that are void of learning." This is what was meant when word was sent from there, from Palestine, to those in Babylon. Let the clusters pray for the leaves, and that the scholars pray for the common folk. For not for the leaves, the common folk, just like leaves are the ones that provide really food for the, you know, they convert through the sun's energy. They convert through the chlorophyll. They create sugars. They create the food for the tree, which ultimately produces the fruit. But not for the leaves, the clusters could not exist. So too, if we're not for the common folk, you should pray on their behalf, even though they themselves are not scholars, but they are very important, you know, to appreciate that their role. When Yosef presented himself to the chief of the butlers and told him that he can interpret dreams, and he says don't interpretations belong to God? So on page 15, he informed that the branch of knowledge of dream interpretation is unlike other areas of wisdom, which are dependent upon intelligence and study. Dream interpretation, on the other, is dependent on an innate psychic ability, and not everyone has this ability. And this is, he's paraphrasing Yosef. I know that I have this innate supernatural psychic ability, even though I've never studied much of this branch of knowledge in schools. And here we, and it came, this is that his interpretation was fulfilled, came to pass the third day, which is Pharaoh's birthday. This is, I'm quoting from the Chumash, and this is in Genesis 40, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker amongst his servants, as he thought about them. And he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. As normally he didn't do this. It was an underling who did this. But it was his birthday, he had the head of the department itself do this. But he hanged the chief baker as Yosef had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Yosef, but forgot him. Why this is so, and the Medrash points out the fact, and you can read this in the bottom, I'm just paraphrasing what the Hamakdover writes. Yosef was a person who had tremendous trust in Hashem. Baruch HaGev Shivtach B'Hashem. Blessed is the person who's, who trusts in Hashem, is referring to Yosef. The fact is, when he interpreted this dream, he besought the chief of the butlers, please remember me. I'm a victim. I was kidnapped and sold into slavery. I'm not really a slave. Listen, I've helped you out with this interpretation. I've calmed you down. I want you to remember me. And he said it twice. It was really out of character. Normally he would have seen this as the hand of God. He would have interpreted, and he would have let God take care of this. But in a sense, on a certain level, Yosef got desperate. And even though for a normal person that would for a normal person that's what would have been required for him to try to influence this chief of the butlers, but for a person on the level of Yosef, had such an intimate relationship with God, it was really out of character, and that's why he was punished. And this chief butler forgot about him for 2 years. But finally, he was released from the dungeon, because Pharaoh himself had a dream. You know, this is the famous dream. You could, as we quote this on page 16, that he had a recurring dream. First, he had seven healthy cows came out of the river, and then seven very gaunt cows, thin, came out of the river and ate up, swallowed. This is all dream form, says, these healthy cows. And he saw again, it says, that seven, says, ears of grain, of corn, were growing, the plump and good. Seven other stalks, very thin, came. He was disturbed by the dream. No one could interpret it to his liking. And now, says the chief butler, remembered Yosef. And Yosef was taken quickly out of the dungeon, and he changed his garments. He was shaved, his hair was cut. And he came to Pharaoh. And the Hamakdover explains, you can see yourself, that how he explained it was, he's a Hebrew, he doesn't resort to sorcery, he was a slave, he didn't go to any special school. It must be, has some divine, innate psychic ability to do this. Pharaoh tells him the dream. Yosef explains to him that it's really a sign to him. There's going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 terrible years of famine. The dream was sent to you to instruct you to prepare for those years of famine, to set aside much of the crop of this year of plenty so you'll have for the years of famine. Pharaoh was so taken by Yosef, of his intelligence, and the fact that he alone was given the insight to interpret the dream, but he was the one to administer all of this. And he continues on here that Yosef rose to power. Initially, as the Malbim explains, he was given over the house of Pharaoh, given continued levels of responsibility until he was made the viceroy. And it's interesting, he was made, the Hamakdover explains, says, according to your word, shall my people be ruled, Yishuk. He says, it explains not only that they'll be ruled, but it's referring to the soldiery, that he was really in charge of all of the soldiers. And the reason being that this campaign to take all of the extras and to store them was a tremendous undertaking. It really had to be done by the National Guard and by the military. And really he was given now charge of this whole operation. As we point out on page 19, that actually he was released on Rosh Hashanah. And as the Gemara explains in Rosh Hashanah, the Jews themselves, even though they left Egypt in the spring, but from Rosh Hashanah, from the beginning of fall itself, the Jews were released from the bitterness of the slavery. In other words, they were stuck in Egypt, but they were not actually worked. And it goes on to say about that how he had fulfilled this Yosef, and he had children now before the years of famine began. He married this woman Osnas, the daughter of Potipharah, the Kohen Oyen, the priest of On, or the chief of On. And he first had a child Menashe, then he had a child Ephraim. And then the famine began in earnest. It not only affected Egypt, but it affected Canaan as well. And here we have on page 20, on paragraph B, on the bottom of the page, and when Jacob saw there was grain in Egypt, and now it's coming full circle. Now this was the means how all the Jews came to Egypt. Because of this famine, they were forced to buy. When Yaakov saw there was grain in Egypt, Yaakov said, why do you look one upon another? Actually, the Talmud interprets this, that when the famine began, actually Jacob, who were an aristocracy in the land of Canaan, they were the last to be hit. No one knew really how long this is going to last. But the people of Canaan started en masse going down to Egypt to buy food. The Jews really didn't have to. But he said, you know, if we don't go down, everyone's going to be jealous of us. His Jews shouldn't stick out. We shouldn't be the thing of jealousy. He says we should just be like everyone else. And if they're all suffering, we should look that we're all suffering too, even though we're not desperate as they are, which is an interesting interpretation. And again, then he said, behold, I've heard there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy for us from there. We may live and not die. And Yosef's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Binyamin, Yosef's brother, Jacob sent not with his brothers, for he said, this was Yosef's brother from their mother Rachel, for he said, lest perhaps harm befall him. And the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who came, for the famine was in the land. We're going to continue this, of course, the story continues on in the next lecture, the last of this series. But one thing the Medrash points out, and here you can see it for yourself on page 21, it was important for Yosef, who became ultimately the leader of Jewry during that period of time, to undergo all the suffering that he did. Because it seems from the Hunar, he was very immature. The fact is he told the dreams, he was very naive, he told the dreams and grated upon the brothers. The whole relationship with the brothers was really an indication that he hadn't reached the maturity that he would eventually realize through all of the suffering that he did. And it was really that suffering that brought him out, that made him the leader that he became. You know, very often in life, and we undergo through, as individuals, we go through different things in our lives. And we wonder, why me? Why am I going through this? Why am I suffering? I mean, Yosef thinks, what am I doing here? He's such a refined person. His brothers are living normal lives. And here he's treated as a common slave. Even though when he rose to power, he was still just a slave. And when he was in the dungeon for all those years, even though he was a chief administrator, he was still a slave. and he was away from home. He was amongst people so far in terms of their morals, of their dreams of life. They're so far from him. It was, why me? But it's really, it all formed him. You know, and it's a lesson really for all of us. You know, there's really the suffering that it was many years of suffering. Until he became actually the king, he was away 13 years. And only later on did he start rising. And good, when he had power and he had a family, but it was still suffering. This is what we quote here with the indicative of the names that he gave his children here on page 20. He says the firstborn was Menashe, for he said, he has made me, says Nishani Elokim is Kol Amoli, he made me forget all of my toil, this Kol Beis Avi and all my father's house. At least I'm numbed. In other words, I'm thankful that at least I forget this because it's a tremendous source of pain for me. The name of his second he called Ephraim, for God's caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. Called the land of his affliction. Still remembered. It was still difficult for him. But it was really that experience that really made him, put him in the position. He became, during this period of time, he was the leader of a jury. Now, is there any questions?
Before, you've always said, my son is funny, that the others give places to their children. When Yosef, for instance, protected his mother from himself, so it says that the eye and her won't be shown on him, that didn't extend to the rest of Klal Yisrael. How is it now, when something that is specific to him, it would make sense to his progeny, but why? How does it extend to other branches, his brothers?
Yeah, the question is asked. We explained, we quoted from Rav Huttner, that it was the power that Yosef had to resist was the seduction that gave the entire Jewish people that strength. And the question was, but the entire Jewish people are not the descendants of Yosef. You could say a person has it, genetically he gives it over. It's part of his DNA. They're not related. I mean, how did he impart this? It seems, and I think the answer is, and this is what Huttner says, that in a certain sense, Yosef uniquely is called an Av also. He is called a spiritual father. And just in a certain sense, just like Avram as the spiritual father of mankind, was able to impart, at least those who joined the Jewish people, to impart to them some of his, even though there's no biological connection, it would seem by his, that there was a, he was given this power to, as an Av of sorts, to impart this to the Jewish people as a whole, even though they were not direct descendants of his. But it's a very good question. A good tovach.